This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Now, I'm delighted to be back here in front of a live audience. In fact, I'm just going to take a picture here. Thank you. This is our first live gig of the year, and we're back here at FizzFest, where the Head School started, actually, back in 2010 at the very first FizzFest. Anyway, our topic here today is Sister Against Sister, Women, the Treaty Split and the Civil War. Now, given their activism in the revolutionary period, now widely acknowledged by historians, why were Irish women and their organisations on the margins of deliberations on the treaty? Why were Irish women under 30 denied the vote in the June 1922 general election? To what extent were they the victims of gendered violence by either side during the Civil War? So to discuss these and related questions, I'm joined by Shifra Aiken, who lectures in history at Queen's University, Belfast, and is the author of Spiritual Wounds, Trauma, Testimony, and the Irish Civil War, published by Irish Academic Press this year. And that'll be reviewed in the next issue, Shifra. Margaret Ward, senior lecturer in history at Queen's University, Belfast, and author of Fearless Women, Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Feminism and the Irish Revolution, published by UCD Press in 2019. And Margaret tells me that she has an updated version of her groundbreaking Unmanageable Revolutionaries, and that was published this year by Arlen House. On my right, regular Head School panellist, Mary McAuliffe, Assistant Professor and Director of Gender Studies at University College Dublin, and author of Margaret Skinner, published by UCD Press in 2020. And finally, on the right, Leanne Lane, who lectures in the School of History and Geography at Dublin City University and is currently working on a biography of Mary McSweeney. Mary McAuliffe, just to get us started, just give us some idea, like, how important, how big an organisation was Cumann na mBan, which is the main women's organisation, you know, in late 1921, you know, before the treaty debate comes along.
Well, if I can borrow a phrase from Margaret's Unmanageable Revolutionaries, when she published it, I think it was 84 when it first came out, 83 when it first came out, a very interesting year. At least that was a good thing in 1983. These were the years of strength of Cumann na mBan during the War of Independence. And it is reckoned there was up to 800 branches around the country, with the Cumann na mBan being an integral part of the guerrilla war that was carried out by the IRA during the War of Independence. And you all probably know what they did during this period. It was the usual things that we think about: running the safe houses, providing medical care, providing food, but also things like intelligence gathering, which was vitally important for any guerrilla army that needed to carry the fight to the Crown forces. I suppose you could compare them to what's happening in the Ukraine today, where, you know, an army on the ground needs the intelligence when it's up against a larger force. Excuse me. So Cumann na mBan provided that, and they were very important in that. So by the time the truce is declared, they are at the height of their strength. They've been through a lot. A lot of them were physically, maybe sexually. We have some evidence of that, and certainly suffered gendered violence during the War of Independence with the Crown forces. Oftentimes they were the ones who were at the butt end of reprisals because they didn't generally go on the run. So they're in the home, and the war, a guerrilla war, will come into the home. So a lot of them suffer a lot of trauma, which, you know, books like Schieffer's details the trauma from war in this period. Even she's looking at the Civil War, but the War of Independence had that trauma as well. So when the truce is declared, I suppose for many it was a relief that the fighting had stopped. But for many of the activists, they're just taking time out to regroup, reorganise. Many of them are participating in the IRA training camps that are happening around the country. They're participating in both a way that is generally gendered, in that they are providing the food in these training camps. They are providing the medical care, first aid in the training camps. But they're also reorganising their own organization at this stage. And then you have interesting episodes like the women who escaped from Mountjoy Jail in 1921. An Etna Coyle, Linda Kearns, I forget the name of the third woman.
May Burke.
Who end up down in Carlow in a training camp. And there's a wonderful photo of them holding rifles and standing on a Union Jack. So these women are not resting on their laurels at this time during from the truce period towards the end of the period, the end of the year in 1921. They're reorganising, as I said. They're also not part of the negotiations that are going on. Particularly, they're not part of the plenipotentiary sent over to negotiate the treaty. And the reason for that generally is women weren't considered political players at this time, even though you had amazing women like Countess Markovitch, like Mary McSweeney, like Hannah Hishi Skeffington, Kathleen Lynn, many of them who would have been very political, very open in their ideologies and in their political views, and very able women, and would have, I would say, have been an interesting addition had they been included in that team that went over to negotiate the treaty. And perhaps it's unfortunate that they weren't on the treaty negotiations because, of course, when the treaty is brought back, they split and come in and have a very negative reaction to that treaty. So the question is, had there been a female representative on the treaty negotiations? But that's the what if of history. But it's interesting to think, had there been a woman on the treaty team, other than the secretaries who were there. There were some women there, and there were women in the background operating on a soft power sort of way. But had there been a woman actually negotiating, but that would have been very, very unusual and indeed unthinkable for the time.
Mary, could we draw a parallel with the labour movement? I mean, the labour movement wasn't represented at the treaty negotiations, yet it had played a huge role, you know, in resistance against the British.
Well, I think the labour movement had kind of, I hate to use the phrase, shot itself in the foot in 1918 when it said labour will wait. And then it gets more and more marginalised politically as the time goes on. And I mean, they had played their part in the War of Independence as well, particularly in, you know, things like making sure that the transport system didn't operate effectively for the Crown forces, because a lot of the train drivers, for example, would have been part of trade unions and would have participated in activism like that. But also with the loss of Connolly, the trade union movement isn't as, in terms of its leadership, as impactful as it had been up to 1916. You don't have the same personalities who can force their way onto the agenda.
I'm thinking of another parallel, which is religious orders of nuns, right? Which in the church governing structure had no role at all, as I understand it. You know, so
they're told what to do.
Is that a legitimate parallel to draw? In other words, you have your own organisation, but it has no role whatsoever in the big decisions.
For women, yes. For the labour movement, probably if they had maybe more effective leaders, they might have been able to force their way onto the agenda. But in many ways, the labour movement wasn't the labour movement it had been up to 1916.
Margaret, can I bring you in here, maybe just talk to us, what actually happens then at the Common Man Convention, the 5th of February 1922?
Right. Well, before that, Common Man are following the treaty debate very closely, and obviously they've got six members who are TDs who've all spoken out against the treaty, but the ordinary members like Maura Comerford or Bridget O'Mahlone say in their memoirs and their testimonies that we didn't like what was going on. Maura Comerford said, what was this Seerstadt that we're seeing, this free state? We wanted the Republic. Where was the Republic going? And so they did stunts like they borrowed Hanishi Skeffington's typewriter and wrote out a letter that they sent to all the big shops, the Switzers and everything, asking for their Union Jacks, saying that there was going to be they were going to hoist them over the treaty talks as a protest, you know, so that they were already preparing to reject the treaty. And so when the treaty is voted on in the Dáil very soon after that, the Cumann na mBan executive votes by 24 to two to reject the treaty. And the two that vote in favour are Jenny Wise Power and Alice Mullen, who was a delegate from Monaghan, which, of course, is one of the counties that manages to stay, you know, not be part of the British during the partition. So she's kind of, she's not as antagonistic as the other Ulster delegates are. So they call this convention on the 5th of February. But I just wanted to say, as somebody from the north, on the 4th of February, the Ulster delegates meet separately and they develop a motion on the north that they want to put to the convention as well, so that the northern delegates and partition is actually, I think, much more prominent in the Cumann na mBan convention than it is in the treaty debates. Anyway, the executive say they uphold the Republic and they refuse to give allegiance to the Articles of Agreement. And that's the motion that's then put to the convention. So there are about 600 delegates. Cork and Kerry, some of the places, because of rail strikes, they can't come. Some branches which are pro-treaty decide there's no point in coming, it's going to be a foregone conclusion. But they do get together and they have a whole day of debate and very strong statements are made, short and pithy statements, basically. But Mary McSweeney introduces the first motion and Jenny Wise Power tries to have a compromise amendment, which is to say, we recognise the treaty as a stepping stone to the Republic, and also that we won't organise against any candidate in the election, because the second motion was introduced by Mrs. Pearce, and that was that when the election on the treaty comes about, Cumann na mBan would only support the candidates standing for the Republic. So those were the two motions that get put. And like Margaret Skinner says very clearly, that it's either the Republic or the Empire. And that's kind of how it's framed. I mean, there are people who do speak in favour of the treaty, but eventually by 419 votes to 63, Cumann na mBan vote against the treaty. But what's interesting...
Are these all individuals in the hall? I mean, yes, they're actually all voting.
And, right, and okay. What's interesting is the only... most people in their memoirs say very little. Like Maura Comerford glosses over it. She actually seconds Mrs. Pearce's amendment on the working in the election. But all she really says in her memoir is we lost some very fine members. I think it was a very, very hard thing for women to talk about because very strong friendships were broken. Maura Comerford does say that she continued to meet Mabel Fitzgerald over cups of tea in Bewley's, and that she felt Mabel was a very reluctant, vote partly because of Desmond. But women found it very, very traumatic. But Elizabeth Corr, who was one of the Belfast women, she wasn't a delegate, but she was an observer from the gallery. And she used to write quite a few newspaper articles as well. And she talks about how dramatic it was that each woman came up and gave her vote herself, you know. So, but you could see the North has been mentioned. Jenny Wise Power says, well, look, the invading army, the army of occupation is now leaving our shores and they're shouting out, no, it's not. It's going to the North. We want the Republic. But nevertheless, even though there is this split and some of them leave, then the other motion is the motion from the northern delegates. And that's if the prisoners in the north, and there are three in Derry jail, they're about to be executed. If they're not released, they'll reimpose the Belfast boycott. And all of them, I mean, Min Mulcahy speaks on that. They all agree on that, which I find really interesting that there wasn't a complete severance straight away. And people like Ethna Coyle and other members of Cumann na mBan are then very active in reimposing the Belfast boycott.
And just to point out to people that there may have been a truce in hostilities in the south, but there was no truce
in the north.
There was no
truce in the north at all, no.
But 500 people were killed between the summer of 1920 and 1922. So the violence continues. So the context is totally different in what became the six counties. Margaret, just before we move on, I mean, is Cumann na mBan the only show in town as regards women's organisations, or are there any other organised groups of women with a view on the treaty?
Well, there are groups of women, for example, from suffrage. Hannah Shee Skeffington talks about the treaty being something that people with a stake in the country, those with property, the clergy and the press, are going to support, and she doesn't. But I think women play a very constructive role just in the immediate prelude to the Civil War, when the occupation of the forecourts has started, and the Women's Peace Delegation. And that takes women from the suffrage movement, also from the labour movement, not only Louis Bennett, but Mary O'Connor and Maura Johnson, and women like Maud Gonne from a kind of non-aligned nationalist perspective. So you have three different groups of women who come together, and they go to both sections of the IRA and the provisional government and try and plead with them not to resort to physical warfare. So that's one group of women. And then when the Civil War actually starts, and prisoners, I mean, there's a huge increase in the imprisonment. Maud Gonne says that she's outside because her son Sean is one of the prisoners after the forecourts collapse. She talks to Sarah Mellows, the mother of Liam Mellows, and so what we need to do something about the prisoners. At this stage, it's not even safe to be on the streets, really. And they set up the Women's Prisoners Defence League. And that performs a really important role in the next few years as really the only visible opposition. And Leanne has a great way of describing it in your book, and Rosamund Jacob, and the kind of how the women are the sort of the theatre outside. You know, they're the ones that you can see, the only ones that you can see, because it's really not safe for men to be out in opposition.
Do you want to come in on that, Leanne? Expand on that?
They keep the visibility. So they're in during the Civil War, women are outside the jails. They're saying the rosary. So they keep kind of visibility of the Republic before the people. And I think as Margaret says, that's something that men aren't able to do because of the danger.
Sheafra, can I just bring in you, because in many respects, this was a global revolution, right? And there were women's organisations outside Ireland. So how did the spit go down elsewhere? I think in the United States in particular, because we've all seen these marvellous photographs of, women, and it's always women protesting at the White House and whatever, in support of the Irish cause.
Yeah, absolutely, Tommy. I think the first thing to say is Cumann na mBan is absolutely global at this stage. So the first branch outside of Ireland, as far as I know, was the New York branch, which was founded in 1914 by Cindy Gifford and Mary Cullum. But there's also branches then that sprung up across the states in the lead up to 1916, a number of branches around Boston, Springfield, Massachusetts, San Francisco. And they're all operating in very different capacities, but there's a movement across the US. We have the same then in England. We have branches in London, in Liverpool. We have branches in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And similarly in Australia as well, we have a Cumann na mBan branch in both Melbourne and Sydney. So this is very much a global organisation. But they function quite differently, I imagine, depending on the area they're in. They're often made up of maybe later generations, like the Irish diaspora, but often young, recently arrived emigrants from Ireland as well. This is a period of high emigration, particularly to the US, up until the end of the 1920s. And what we'll find is, rather than being involved in more direct activity like we might have in Ireland, that fundraising is a huge part of the diasporic Cumann na mBan organisations. And women are really at the centre of that, particularly in the US. And that's visible both in terms of how many tours we have leading up to 1922 of women travelling on these lecture tours all across the US. I know that Mary can talk about Margaret Skinner's tour, and Margaret can talk about Hannah Shee Skeffington. And Mary McSweeney, of course, was in the US from all through 1921. And they're really at the centre of this discourse. And part of it is because they are able to talk from an emotional level of what they'd experienced and what they'd seen. And it was actually seen to be a successful tactic in terms of getting money as well, that people would, they were able to pull on the heartstrings maybe of these huge audiences across the States and get money. And then on a more local level, young Irish-American women are very active in collecting outside, whether that be on the streets and so on. So then what happens in with the treaty, there's an absolute split in the US, like there is here. I think already Irish America was quite fractured. There was all sorts of, as you can imagine, in any kind of organisation, there was all sorts of splits on dynamics, a split between John Devoy and Joseph McGarrity that would have had very different visions in terms of their views on Irish nationalism and Irish republicanism. But what I think is interesting here is that we already mentioned that Cumann na mBan take a very prominent anti-treaty stance in Ireland, and we see that happening in the US as well. So Gertrude Kelly, who is really central to the New York branch of Cumann na mBan in New York, is very vocal about this, and she's a really interesting character, and I'm sure Mary will be able to talk more about her, but she was born in Carrick and Shore, and then she's pacifist, anti-war, highly involved in suffrage, involved in various organisations. But she actually speaks to the New York Times and says that all of the Irish American women are against the treaty. And this is published in the New York Times. And this comes back then to Ireland and causes a bit of dismay. And I think one of the more powerful quotes from Jenny Wise Power, who supports the treaty, is that she laments the fact that an idea has gone abroad that all of the women are against the treaty. And I think that really sums up the despair in her behalf, that she feels maybe more isolated, that the whole diaspora is also...
I mean, it was highly unlikely, but Irish women in America in particular, I mean, my impression is that the American organisations were generally pro-treaty.
Yeah, well, actually, just to come in, and this is the last point I was going to make, what's really interesting is that you're right, Tommy, the Irish American organisations, most of them were pro-treaty, Friends of the Irish Freedom, the other group, which is probably the biggest group, is the Ancient Order of Hibernians. But what's absolutely fascinating is the Ancient Order of Hibernians takes a pro-treaty line, but the Ladies' Auxiliary goes against the men's organisation, and the leader is Mary MacArthur of Chicago, and she was actually in Ireland in 1922, as far as I know. But they actually take an anti-treaty stance against the main organisation. So again, we can see that difference across gender lines. I think there's a lot of exceptions to that, but the women themselves also... promoted that idea that there was a gender division. I think Hanny Sheehy-Skeffington has a quote saying that there was a gender division, that the men in the House were pro-treaty and the women were anti. Obviously, that's not the full picture, but it definitely seems to have been very strong examples of it.
Now, Leon, if I go to you, a mention has been made several times here of Mary McSweeney, right? Now, I think maybe many of the people listening will know Mary McSweeney as the sister of Terence McSweeney, you know, whereas in fact... he was probably better known as her brother. Just talk to us about Mary McSweeney, because she's central to our discussion.
Yeah, so Mary McSweeney is one of six female deputies in the Second Dáil, and all six female deputies were against the treaty, but she probably was the most visible female deputy against the treaty, not least because she spoke for over two and a half hours on the 21st of December 1921, and possibly actually forced the recess because she spoke for so long. She actually spoke for longer than the five plenipotentiaries together. She was somebody who was very active in Republican politics in Cork. Initially, she was a suffrage activist, but when the First World War broke out, she concentrated on nationalism. She makes the point in the treaty debates that none of her family joined Sinn Féin until Sinn Féin is fully Republican.
Who was active first, she or the brother?
I think there's a synergy. I think, Padraig Burka says in the Dáil debates, it's hard to know when she was speaking, was she Terence's disciple or was she Terence's teacher? And I think
That's a bit of a put-down, though. That's a bit of, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think what he's actually saying is that she was an activist in her own right, that she's not just the grieving sister of Terence. I think they very much had a kind of a similar idea of Ireland fully free Republican Gaelic, and they influence each other, is what I would say. I wouldn't just suggest that she's somebody who's the grieving sister. She's heavily involved in establishing Cumann na mBan in Cork in 1914. Now, she is very strident, and even before the treaty split occurs, there's rowing in Cork, Cumann na mBan, and she's kind of to the fore of that. Or, she's involved in prisoner aid. Terence, of course, is arrested on numerous occasions from January 1916, and she herself was one of two women arrested in Cork in 1916. She just spent overnight in prison herself, Nora O'Brien. She, of course, comes to prominence within the Republican elite, the male Republican elite, I think, when she goes over to America in 1920. Initially, she's seen as just Muriel's sister-in-law, accompanying Muriel to speak who at the American Commission on Inquiry into Conditions in Ireland. But once she starts to speak, she galvanises those who are listening. And De Valera actually tasks her with taking on the Republican bond drive in America. He's leaving America in December 1920, and it's quite a big thing to task a woman with this. As somebody mentioned, as Shebra mentioned, she spent from late 1920 until August 1921 in America doing a huge amount of publicity work. And she's a woman in her mid-40s at this point, and she's travelling across America. She's doing long train journeys and then speaking to huge audiences. And at this point, she has actually a lot of traction within Republicanism at the level of elite politics. But once she comes back to Ireland, she's elected unopposed to the second Dáil for Sinn Féin members for Cork. But once she comes back, her stridency seems to annoy members of the Republican males, the males within the deputy, within the Dáil, both on the Republican and on the pro-treaty side. She talks about how Arthur Griffith was sneering at her as she spoke for so long. And she says, "I care not if I take more of your time than you are willing to give." She says she's every right to speak for that length of time on the basis of what she endured in Brixton for 74 days watching her brother in hunger strike. And she does, from that point, begin to be seen as a type of cipher for extreme Republicanism, which I think is very gendered, because there were men also who were very anti the treaty, but because she was a woman standing up in this kind of very assertive, educated, intelligent way, she's not actually knowing her place.
No, but I mean, this, you know, plus ça change. I mean, this is like, you know, we got this with the recent Northern Ireland Assembly elections. Naomi Long, you know, the kind of abuse she gets, right? You know, all female candidates. Now, so let's talk about that. Maybe bring you, Margaret. The way the women were attacked, the anti-treaty women were othered, you know, in this whole debate, depicted as, you know, hysterical, you know, as, anyway.
Well, they first of all say, you know, the women are all warped by their deep personal loss, etc. So, you know, Mary McSweeney's lost her brother, Mrs. Pierce has lost two sons.
Kate
O'Callaghan's lost her husband and brother, etc. You know, so it's again women being irrational. All of their reasoning is based on emotion rather than any kind of intellect. Except that you've also got Constance Markovitch and Ada English, who, as Ada English says, "I have no dead men to sort of be thrown back at me," and you know. And all the women, when you read, and Kate O'Callaghan, of course, her husband, the mayor, has been murdered as well in front of her. But when you read what the women say, I mean, all right, Mrs. Pierce doesn't speak a lot, and she says basically that she does stand there for her sons, which I think one could absolutely reasonably expect her to do that when she's lost two sons and hadn't been particularly involved in political life before that. But she's very clear that she sees a republic. But the women see it not simply as an abstract ideal. They often talk about the proclamation and the ideals of 1916. And the proclamation is the first time, as Hannah Shee Skeffington says, in history, men fighting for freedom have voluntarily included women. So women are guarantee equal rights and opportunities, equal citizenship. And what they're seeing in the treaty doesn't come close to the bare bones of the proclamation. And so women are talking from a perspective that they know that their lives or women's lives are not going to be altered for the better through what the treaty is offering them. And I think that that needs to be seen much more, and what women are saying needs to be scrutinised much more.
Did any of the women, maybe Shea, for you, come in on this, in their later testimonies, any of the women talk about this, about this vicious reaction against them, you know? Any comment on that, or was it just accepted?
Yeah, you know, I think with the women's testimonies, it's always a little bit more subtle, maybe. So on testimony that I've been, I suppose, the last number of years looking at that, the idea that there was a silence against about the Irish Civil War, and when we actually look beyond that, that wasn't the case, that there was many attempts to write down stories and to put testimonies into the public domain, and really in the 1920s and 30s. But what you find is that women are very restricted in how they can represent themselves. So we can talk about that in a very basic level in terms of publishing, in terms of finding an audience, going through the Talbot Press archives here in Dublin. You can actually just see that Dorothy McArdle's stories rejected in Dublin, so she's getting them published in the US. Hannah Shee Skeffington's memoirs told to be of slim literary value. So what we see then is that women, because of these uncertainties, the difficulty in finding an audience, is that they'll generally publish through maybe a concealed veil somewhat. And that's what I've actually argued, is that if we look at the amount of fictionalised writings by women in the 1920s and 30s, they actually far outweigh the direct autobiographies from the Irish Civil War. Because really, in terms of autobiographies that were published anyway, Margaret Buckley's Jail Journal from the end of the 1930s is the only one that we see in press. And this is still an issue. We see Margaret Comerford's memoirs only been published this year, and they were published in Irish in the 1980s. But it's not that the women didn't write testimonies and they didn't want to document the experience, and they wrote extensive jail journals and diaries. But it was that act of putting it in front of the public.
Couldn't get a publisher then, basically.
Yeah, and that's why it's really interesting in that if we look at some of the novels that they wrote, they're using this veil of fiction to testify to their experience. Annie P. Smithson, Coming to Man member, wrote a romance novel in the 30s and two, three chapters of her Civil War experience in Dublin, the Battle of the Four Courts, then in Mullingar, and when she's imprisoned, with a very, very light veil. She changes Mullingar to McGarlin, I think, is it McGarlin? So she changes a very, very subtle detail. But just to come back to that question, that idea of how did they address how they were demonised, I suppose. I suppose that's where it's tricky. I can't think of any example where they are very directly, I suppose, protesting to that. But that's not to say that they aren't doing that in indirect ways. And I think if we look at all the indirect ways in which they do that, and it's a fantastic novel, Gareth O'Driscoll published, written in 1924, and we can see the female protagonist, the pressures, and how she's under huge societal pressure, and yet she's trying to negotiate all of that. So obviously that's a reflection on what's happening. And just another thing to say about this whole, the demeaning of the women, it's also a psychosexual dehumanisation. So we have that in terms of them being hysteric. So I think that means that women's pain or women's trauma is discredited, because women are not actually in pain or they haven't suffered. This is them just being hysteric and neurotic girls. So it's not being validated. And then the same with the sexual criticism, that these are women are unsexed, that their mother's milk is blackened with gunpowder. That also brings up questions, and I think we'll talk about this later, but in terms of the gendered violence and the sexual violence, one of the things that I've noticed in testimonies is disclaimers about not being assaulted. And why was that necessary? And what was that? And what taboo was built around that?
Tell you what, I just want to hold that point for a second. Before we go back to Mary, I just wanted to just repeat what Annette said at the outset, just about the setup here at the Hedge School. I'm glad I can see you're all sitting very quietly there paying attention, but don't relax too much, because you are at school here and you're meant to participate. And we don't just have a Q&A at the end. So if at any stage any of you have any questions, just put your hand up. And Amy here has a radio mic. And just make sure you use the mic, because, you know, this is being recorded. So keep it clean. Anyway, so you can jump in at any stage, right? Just to make that clear. Mary, before we wrap up this section on the split itself, right? Obviously, we're talking a lot here about the anti-treaty women, but what about the pro-treaty women? And I'm thinking in particular about Cumann and Saoirse. Who or what were they?
Well, of course, when the split happens at the convention, as Margaret described it, and those great women that good members, Mara Comerford said, left. Well, these were political women. They'd been used to organising, and they were not going to just go quietly into the good night, basically, and do nothing about the fact that the organisation they'd been part of for many years was now doing something they didn't agree with. So in March, early March of 1922, another meeting is held at the Mansion House, at which there are around 600, 700 delegates. And this is to launch the new pro-treaty women's organisation, which is given the title Cumann na Saoirse.
That's quite a substantial, 600 again, that's a lot of people,
yeah.
You know.
Well, the newspapers say there was 1,500 there, but between all the different reports, I reckon it was about 700, about the same, around the same amount or a little bit more than had been at the convention the month before. And you have the women who were leaders in Cumann na Mban, some of them founders of Cumann na Mban, now founding Cumann na Saoirse, like Jenny Wise Power. You had Min Mulcahy, who was one of the Ryan sisters of Tom Coole. She had been the fiancé, or certainly girlfriend, of Sean McDermott, for example, and one of the last people to see him before he was executed. She married Richard Mulcahy, who is now a pro-treaty government minister. Alice Stopford Green, interestingly, Mara Comerford had spent most of the War of Independence as secretary to Alice Stopford Green in her house on Stephen's Green. And there you see a split directly between two women who knew each other, with Alice Stopford Green going pro-treaty and Mara Comerford anti-treaty. People like Kathleen Brown, who was best friends with Nell Ryan, sister of Min Ryan, one went pro-treaty, Kathleen Brown, and the other anti-treaty. They never spoke to each other again, and indeed during the Civil War threatened to have each other burnt out in their various homes in South Wexford. So this split is quite traumatic and quite serious. And Cumann na Saoirse hits the ground running. Basically, they decide to fight for the treaty, fight for the pro-treaty candidates in the upcoming election. And as we're sitting here near the grave of Michael Collins, basically they use that same argument that Collins used, that this is a stepping stone. This isn't all they had fought for. This isn't even a really desired outcome to what they had fought for. But it is something that will give them the opportunity to then go on and achieve the Republic. So it is that stepping stone argument. And they begin doing the things that Cumann na Mban had done, excuse me, up to that period. They're fundraising, they're organising. Once the Civil War breaks out, there are branches being set up all around the city. And there's about 12 branches. I've been going through the newspapers to get reports of the different branches of Cumann na Saoirse. And there's actually quite a lot of branches in the city. There's one in Glasnevin, the one in Stony Batter. There's one in the central executive is in the city, of course. Then you've a number of branches on the south side. Then you've branches all around the country, from Donegal to Kilkenny, in the Midlands. The only place I couldn't find a branch of Cumann na Saoirse actually was in Kerry. There's one or two branches in Cork. There seem to be less branches where the Civil War is going to be at its most furious, which will be in Munster. Although there is a very active branch in Tipperary, in Care, and in Clonmel. And their branches
in active. How active?
Well, they're very active. They're organising ceilidhs. They're fundraising for the National Army. They're providing visiting for soldiers wounded during the Civil War. But they're also doing things like they're providing intelligence to the National Army when it comes into their area. They're keeping an eye on their erstwhile comrades in Cumann na Mban and providing information about them to the National Army. And of course, it is during the Civil War you have a huge amount of women arrested, anti-treaty women, and imprisoned, as we know, in Kilmainham, Mountjoy, and then in the North Dublin Union, but also in local jails. We tend to forget about that a little bit, in that they're not kept as long in local jails, but they are being imprisoned. Women are being imprisoned in local jails. And so they're being turned in by their erstwhile comrades. They're also being used as what had been organised during the War of Independence, lady searchers. So when Cumann na mBan women are being arrested, you need a woman to search them. So sometimes they call in the Cumann na Saoirse women, and that's where
who might be their former comrade. I mean,
yeah, they know them, and that's where they get the term Cumann na Saoirtears. They're also there when the women are being transferred from Kilmainham and Mountjoy to the North Dublin Union. There's a lot of violence there, which they seem to be participating in, because we do have details from memoirs that are not published. I was looking at Annie O'Farrelly's writings in the National Library there the other day, where she describes the transfer of the prisoners to the North Dublin Union, and being dragged out of jails. And there was five Cumann na Saoirse searchers there, she says. And they are stripping the women. They are searching them. They're, you know, participating in the fact that these women are being flung downstairs and thrown into waiting trucks, et cetera, et cetera. But that, on the other side as well, the Cumann na mBan women are also attacking the Cumann na Saoirse women. Celia Shaw, who was a Cumann na Saoirse organiser, is driven out of Clonmel. When she comes there to organise, she's kidnapped and held overnight and given a talking to. It's not said what happens to her, but I'm sure they weren't treating her very nicely and told never to show her face again. They produce pro-treaty propaganda, same as the anti-treaty women produce Republican propaganda. For example, Jenny Wise Power's businesses in Dublin are firebombed a number of times, as are the Cumann na Saoirse headquarters of the executive in just off Parnell Street. They had an office there, and that was firebombed a couple of times. So you have that bitterness between the two organisations, and also personal animosities. Sheila Humphreys organised that a number of young women who wouldn't be too well known join Cumann na Saoirse. They're actually anti-treaty, but she asked them to join Cumann na Saoirse because they feel that Cumann na Saoirse are using what they call these call houses, where people are coming and passing information to pass on information about the anti-treaty IRA. So they're being spied on. So that is why I think the title of this Hedge School is very valid, in that this is sister against sister during the Civil War. And it is bitter, and it is vicious, and it has a long legacy. Possibly because the Irish Free State turned out to be a very patriarchal, theocratic state that basically galvanised itself to go up against women's rights, that the women eventually coming together.
But going back to the Cumann na Saoirse, like, I mean, they didn't get much thanks for their efforts, in the sense that I'm assuming they just faded away once the Civil War was over.
Well, they didn't actually just fade away. They actually end themselves. Like, there is no more reason. Around December 1923, there's no reason for them to continue existing. So they actually put a notice in the newspaper to say they are dissolving the organisation. But a lot of the women are going into different organisations within the Free State then. And the senior leadership of Cumann na Saoirse, well, you have, you know, Alice Stopford Green, Jenny Wise Power are in the Senate at this stage. So they're getting senior positions. A lot of them are related to or married to senior men within Cumann na Gael or within the National Army. If you look at the list, they hold dances. They hold balls and dances in Dublin. If you look at the list at who's attending these dances, you can see it's all the senior leadership, both military and political, of the new Irish Free State. So they're very well connected. Down the country, perhaps they're not of the same elite status, the members of Cumann na Saoirse. They're younger as well. But they are part of the elite, the political elite of the new Irish Free State, or certainly married into it.
Now, before we move on to the Civil War, I just wanted to go to the question of the franchise, right? Because women over 30 got the vote in the UK general election of December 1918. Mm-hmm. Now, under the new constitution then for the Irish Free State, they were to get the vote. But they didn't get the vote, Margaret, did they?
They didn't get the vote then, no. Like, Hannah Skeffington has this great phrase she often uses, you know, we're promised, you know, jam yesterday and jam tomorrow, but never jam today. So, you know, we're going to be in a free state when others have voted us in. But Constance Markievicz writes to her sister to say that the younger women, the women aged between 21 and 30, she says the demand arose quite spontaneously, that women had been working in the War of Independence, but they'd also been working in polling booths, not only in 1918, but during the local government elections of 1920. They'd seen the democratic process, but now they weren't going to be able to take part in it. And so a free state was going to be voted on. But and remember, it wouldn't only have been the young women between 21 and 30, but a lot of young men would have turned 21. And because the electoral registers...
They were using the old register.
Yeah.
An out-of-date register,
essentially.
A completely out-of-date register.
So there was an argument about democracy, that this was such a momentous decision to be made on the future of Ireland. How could you leave out basically the younger generation? And so women... from a number of women's organisations, Franchise, the Women's International League for Peace, but also Cumann na mBan, go in delegations both to Griffith and then separately to De Valera to say that would they grant women over 21 the vote.
Who was lying the Franchise and why?
Who was what?
Who was blocking the, well, the extending, you know, bringing in the new electoral register?
Well, isn't... Well, there's lots of different answers to that. So Griffith says it's going to take 7 months to update the register. We cannot wait that long. The British want a decision now. He's kind of, you know, hinting all the time that they're under pressure. And people are saying, well, why should we be pressurised, you know? And Griffith is then saying, but really it's a demand to torpedo the treaty by the anti-republicans. This is just another... tactic that they've adopted.
But is that based on the assumption then that all these women are going to vote anti-treaty?
Well,
that's a big assumption, isn't it?
It is a big assumption, but Hannah reckons that a seventh of the electorate would have been young women between 21 and 30. So, and then if you take the young men as well, so it would have been a substantial amount of the electorate. And it could easily, I would have argued, changed the course of Irish history if the electoral register had been changed. So after the delegations in February, Kate O'Callaghan in the Doyle on the 2nd of March introduces a motion to give women the vote between the ages of 21 and 30 before the treaty is voted on. And the debate is slightly truncated. Mary McSweeney, in fact, kind of protests at the end that it's been shut down. There's only Kate O'Callaghan and Constance Markovich from that side who are able to talk about it. Plenty of the men do. But Kate starts off by saying, talking about the proclamation, talking about the role women have played, and talking about just simple justice, basic justice, to give women the chance to have their say now. And then you've got De Valera and people like that who you know are not, you know, the strongest feminists in the world. They don't really talk in the debate about women. It's all about the technicalities and the mechanics, and it could, you know, the electoral register could be updated much quicker. So that the men who are in this uncomfortable position are trying to support the women but can't really bring themselves to support the women on purely kind of feminist grounds.
So
and that motion is defeated basically on a pro-treaty, anti-treaty lines.
So it's kind of, it's not direct opposition to it, it's more like just obfuscation, like they just delay it. I mean, the people who don't want to extend it, I mean.
Yes, well, Griffith says that the first promise is that there will be... women's rights, you know, to citizenship will be enshrined in the Free State Constitution when it's published.
But that's
only after.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, it's interesting.
And even then, Ernest Blythe tries to water it down to women's equal political rights rather than women's equal citizenship rights. And there has to be another protest by women, which is something that I'm only aware of much more recently, so that they're still trying to water it down. Women still have to keep an eye on what is happening throughout this time.
No, it's just ironic because it seems to me that the reason they were denied the vote was the assumption that they were too radical. But the funny thing is, in France, on the other hand, the argument for not extending votes to women until 1945 was a left-wing argument because they were assumed to be too conservative, right? So you can, there were all sorts of reasons were picked to deny women the vote, it seems to me, in different jurisdictions. Just the thing is, women did get the vote in the 1923 election, Margaret. But I mean, you know, did it make any difference?
Well, I've read the British feminist press on that, and they say it's too early to tell really the impact. But certainly at the moment, we can say that feminism doesn't seem to be, you know, uppermost, or you couldn't say that the younger generation of women were particularly radical. But on the other hand, you've still got the legacy of the Civil War. So you've got Noreen Brewer gets a really big vote. You get, you know, Mary McSweeney has returned. I mean, the women, some of the really well-known women on the anti-treaty side get very big
votes. But they're abstentionist TDs at this stage.
But the point is not many women are put forward, so you don't have an awful lot to base it on either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on the other hand, the anti-treaty vote goes up considerably, and the amount of candidates that are elected from the anti-treaty side does increase.
By the way, just going back to the 1918 election, because I've asked this question several times and never got an answer, right? But I'm not sure if there is an answer. But I mean, is there any evidence at all, anecdotal or otherwise, that you know, women were waiting in the long grass for the Irish Parliamentary Party? You know, they voted against them and for Sinn Féin in 1918. Mary,
Jenny Wise-Parr talks about it.
Okay.
She said that we didn't forget what they did in 1912.
Right. Okay. Yeah, okay. So there was a radical voting constituency out there.
Well,
you seem to be saying.
Well, they were. I wouldn't say it was radical. They remembered who were their friends and who weren't their friends.
Well, some of them did, but Mary Kettle, for example, voted for the Irish Party because Tom Kettle, her husband, had died, and he'd been a member of the party. You know, so there's a lot of personal reasons on how you voted as well. But I would have said that the majority were Sinn Féin supporters by then.
Just one other thing before I get on to the Civil War itself, Mary, maybe I was talking about this beforehand. Just when we're talking here about the radicalism or otherwise of Irish women, how does it compare with elsewhere in Europe? You know, I mean, how radical or unradical can we expect Irish women to be, you know, at this time?
Well, if you do a comparative thing, I've just finished working on a book which will be out later this year, on women in different revolutionary movements in Europe in the 1912 to 1921 period. So there are different chapters from Austria, Finland, Hungary, everything except the Russian Revolution, actually. We just put that to the side because that's the big one. And what I found out in doing that, and that's number one, that there were revolutions in almost every European country, either during the First World War, when they were in part of that war, or immediately post First World War, and that women were central to almost all of those revolutions. And yet in the histories written about them, similar to our own, they were not written into those histories. And one example I give you is the potato revolution that happened in Finland, which was started by women because of prices, because of food insecurity, as we would phrase it today, and price rises. And they begin agitating around that. And then that turns into a more political revolution. And the leadership then becomes more male. And then the women's issues get sidelined. And when the revolution is written off later on, what began as a woman's issue doesn't make it into that narrative of that particular revolution. But you can see there's a huge amount of women throughout Europe, and indeed many of them are in touch with the Irish women, and the Irish women are aware of what is going on in various parts because they're reading of it in newspapers, they're reading of it through their association with also British feminists, the more radical British feminists. And there are women involved from Germany, from Finland, Austria, everywhere. They were involved in that. Interestingly, in doing this book with these different scholars from across Europe, Ireland comes out really well in terms of the decade of centenaries and commemorating 100 years later women's participation in revolution. In fact, we're way ahead of all the other countries in terms of how we are writing women's issues back into that narrative and women's participation and commemorating women. And yet, at the same time, I still think we have still so much to do. But actually, it was interesting to see that we have done a lot more than perhaps some other countries in understanding The radical women's organisations that did exist in the early 20th century, not just the ones we know about around, you know, the Rosa Luxemburgs and that, but in smaller revolutions that happened in various countries throughout Europe. There were also right-wing women as well at that period, because, of course, we're heading into the 1920s, and they were very much involved in that other side as well. So no more than there was a split in say, anti-treaty, pro-treaty in Ireland, in other European countries, you do have that left-right split as well, and women are involved in both throughout this period.
Now, before I move on to the talk about the Civil War, just to remind you guys, we've about 30 minutes left, so if you want to compose a question, now's the time to get it in, because once these people start talking, you won't get a word in edgeways. So just if you just compose yourselves there and put your hand up if you want to make a contribution. Now, I just want to move on to the Civil War itself. Margaret, what sort of roles did women play in this conflict, and how effectively?
Okay, well, I mean, women were absolutely vital and indispensable to this. And you can see, as Mary said about the imprisonment figures, so you've got, you know, between 500 and 600 women imprisoned, and you compare that to the War of Independence, where you had about 50 women. So it's an indication of how active they are. And I think one of the things to say is that there was no women having to beg to be let in, unlike 1916. The men were absolutely desperate for the help of the women. So when the forecourt is attacked by heavy artillery, you know, it's heard all over Dublin. So and women have written about their experiences. So Maura Comerford is out in Roebuck House at the time with Maud Gonne and Charlotte Despard, and she hears it and gets on her bike and rushes in. Margaret Skinner talks about hearing it, and she and Nora Connolly come in. So women suddenly report for duty, if you like. Some of them are in the forecourts, which is the headquarters of the anti-treaty IRA. Maura Comerford, for example, is delivering messages between the forecourts and the different outposts in Dublin in the different hotels that they've taken over. And when you read her pension application, Oscar Traynor, who was the OC in charge of the IRA in Dublin at the time, he talks about her being an inspiration and how she ever managed to cross over the streets riddled with gunfire, delivering her messages. She talks about how the women were just, she was just taught how to use reverse gears in order to drive the big lorry and deliver supplies. I mean, I just find them extraordinarily cool and brave to be doing all of this. Other women, like, for example, the Connollys, Leslie Price, and all those, Tara Hall was a first aid centre. But in the forecourts, people like Madge Clifford was baking bread for 180, how she did it, you know, and trying to keep morale up and trying to look after the troops. After the fall of the forecourts, the battle then goes to the Dublin hotels. And by the end, when Dublin has fallen, you've, I think, 70 men and 30 women there. Markovitch Morrissey's standing on the roof of one of the hotels as a sniper. And women, they're doing whatever they could do best. Nobody was telling them this time, you can't do this, as Margaret Skinner's role in 1916. Now they were doing what they could do, and the men don't seem, you know, were grateful for their support. But then when the struggle moves south and they break up into smaller and smaller units, you could argue that what women were doing then was even more important, because they were the one delivering the messages. In Dublin, Bridie O'Milan had a little group. She was the director of propaganda. She was, you know, they were publishing the war news. They were making sure Cathal Brewer's widow had said that only women should be at his funeral. So for all the Republican funerals, and there were many, it was the women who were the escorts, the guards of honour, doing all of that work as well. So again, they were the visible opposition. But as the fighting intensified and the small little guerrilla groups, you had women like Leslie Price, who was working with Sean Lamass, and she was the conduit between different groups of the IRA, different brigade and battalions. And she said it was really dangerous because if you delivered a message to one group, they might take you as hostage, because if they had a woman there, they felt they were more likely to get safe passage and not be stopped by the Free State troops. It becomes more and more dangerous for both women and men. I think four women were killed during the fighting, during the Civil War. But I think that one of the most poignant things, and I think kind of sums up the hostility of the Free State to the women and the fact that they didn't really care who they imprisoned, is that when you come to Kilmainham in 1923, Easter 1923, that the women who were there and who conduct the ceremony are Nora Connolly, there's the sister, the relatives of the O'Rahilly. There's Lily O'Brennan, who's the sister-in-law of Eamon Cant. There's Grace Plunkett, the widow. You know, so that they're the ones. And Lily O'Brennan is actually in the cell that Eamon Cant was in before he was executed. So these women, as Dorothy McArdle writes in Heir of the Irish Nation, it's as if the voice of our dead leaders was speaking to us again as the women did through the ceremony, so that they are the witness for the sort of the hopes and idealism of 1916, but they're the ones imprisoned. And I think it really sums up the difference between the two camps. But what, just to finish, the last thing is that when the ceasefire is announced, women are not consulted. And when De Valera has his legion of the rear guard address, the women are not mentioned.
Well, that was consistent.
Or anything. Yeah, but so,
from what happened before.
But if you look at just the written stuff, you can see, well, you wouldn't see where the women were. And I think it's so important that we have the pension applications and all the witness statements, because those are so vivid and they tell us so much more. We know so much more in the last few years than we ever knew before about women's Civil War experiences.
Leanne, can I go to you on the prisoners, right? I mean, am I right in assuming there were more women in jail during the Civil War than during the War of Independence? Is that correct?
Yes, as Margaret just said, there was around 50 women in prison during the War of Independence, and at the higher end of the estimate, there's over 600 women in prison during
600?
The Civil War. Oh, it makes sense, because if you think about it, during the War of Independence, women's roles diversified. Some were working directly for the IRA. They were a vital kind of part of the kind of IRA army chain, and the men who accepted the treaty and were trying to put in place a new state knew the potential of women they had worked previously with to destabilise that state.
So they're victims of their earlier success.
Absolutely. And that, of course, means that there's a huge amount of overcrowding in the prisons. They're not equipped for all those.
Just go back there. So 600 women. How many men are in jail? Just to give the comparison. Anyone?
It's about 15,000.
Yeah. That's close enough. Like, we're in the nearest.
Yeah.
About 15,000.
1,500.
1,500. Okay, so it's about like 2-1, 3-1.
Yeah. And they're not equipped because there's a huge amount of overcrowding. So Mountjoy is the key first prison in Dublin, and there's a huge amount of overcrowding because they're not just arresting women in Ireland, they're also deporting women from Britain. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of rioting in Mountjoy in the period, the late 1922.
Women rioting.
So there is free association within the Civil War sites of incarceration. So women are allowed to interact with each other during the day. They hold classes in Irish language, Irish history, but then there's a certain lock-up time. And as a result of overcrowding in Mountjoy, there's an attempt by some women to actually refuse to go into the cells at lock-up time, and they also broke furniture, leading then, of course, to sanctions. Another very important thing about the Civil War female imprisonment is that they engage in hunger strike. So Mary McSweeney's arrested on the 4th of November 1922 in Suffolk Street, and immediately she goes on hunger strike in Mountjoy, and there's initially a sympathetic hunger strike. She encourages the women who are on sympathetic hunger strike to come off the sympathetic hunger strike, but when Dorothy McArdle, for example, goes into Mountjoy on the 9th of November, she talks in her prison diary about how the whole of Mountjoy female wing was reverberating with the potential of Mary McSweeney's death. Mm-hmm. And of course, the government were absolutely determined that they were not going to release any women. Cosgrave, you know, we talked about othering of women. Cosgrave described these women as no ordinary women because they were hunger striking, because they were involved in anti-treaty Republican activism. And there's a really interesting kind of discussion in the newspapers about the fact that Terence McSweeney's sister might be allowed to die in a Free State prison. And at one point, in fact, Annie McSweeney comes up from Cork to visit her sister and she's not permitted to enter Mountjoy. And you have the situation which is a huge nightmare for the Cosgrave government, for the provisional government at that point. One McSweeney's sister in prison, hunger striking, and another McSweeney's sister outside the jail on hunger strike. But there's letters to Cosgrave, you know, from both sides telling him that, you know, if they let the sister of Terence McSweeney die, that would be just a travesty. But then there's also letters saying, you know, don't let these suffragettes, you know, behave like this. These wild women behave like this. But that's not the only hunger strike. Mary McSweeney's imprisoned three times during the Civil War. She's released kind of very quietly at the end of November. She goes to a nursing home. She's arrested very briefly in February, but left go after a night. And then she's arrested again in April 1923, sent to Kilmainham. And again, she's on hunger strike in Kilmainham.
How do these hunger strikes end, though?
Well, in November, the government capitulated and they released her. There was another hunger strike for 1 week in March in 1923 in Kilmainham. The government, again, kind of capitulates slowly, or the women do come off the hunger strike. Then, of course, there's a hunger strike in the North Dublin Union. And then in the large hunger strike, and actually in the hunger strike in the North Dublin Union, there's a lot of discussion. It's Comerford who's on hunger strike, isn't it? Yeah. And the women make a lot of propaganda value out of the hunger strike. So this is one way in which they express themselves. ERA, the Republican broadsheet or Republican propaganda sheet, makes a huge amount of kind of propaganda value out of the way in which women were treated in the Civil War jails. You know, the fact, you know, if you think about patriarchy, the brutality of patriarchy is masked under the language of chivalry. It's the duty of men to protect women, to look after the fairer and weaker sex. But here was the provisional government, later the Free State government, actually brutalising women in the jails. And something else that comes out from the accounts that we have from the jails is that there's all the time kind of a low level of violence, which erupts then into a certain flashpoints of high violence. The transfer from Kilmainham to the North Dublin Union being an example. But there is always the fear of violence. You know, the soldiers' gaze on these women. Pauline O'Keefe, who's the deputy, or who's the prison warden in Kilmainham, keeps going around with a gun on his holster, mm-hmm. saying, you'd be shot. And some women do lose, are actually...
Are they more brutally treated than they would have been under the British?
Mary McSweeney argues that she was her experience in Mountjoy was worse than the experience of Terence in Brixton, because she makes the point that they were actually able to be with Terence in Brixton, whereas Annie isn't allowed in. Of course, she also makes the point that the Catholic Church behaved very differently to Terence than they behaved to her, because of course the October Joint Bishops Pastoral meant that she was denied sacraments, etc.
But, you know, Maura Comerford is waving out of the window to some of the prisoners in the exercise yard and the Free State shooter in the leg.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a trigger-happy kind of really desperate environment.
Because I was just reading a military service pension file about Agnes Gallagher from Mayo, and she was imprisoned in Kilmainham in 1923, and she was a music teacher. She's quite an older woman at that point, and she's looking out a bit like Maura Comerford, and she is actually shot, and she loses her eyesight, and she's no longer able to... conduct her profession as a music teacher. So it was trigger happy, yes.
And there are a few applications made by family members of women who die soon after they come out of Mountjoy, or the North Dublin Union, actually, because their health has been impacted by not just going on regular hunger strikes that many of them did, but also the nutrition in there and the low-level violence and probably not getting any sleep, and there would have been a lot of lice and just bad health.
I think it's
during this period,
to say,
but also psychologically.
Say also, though, that like the women in their accounts very much kind of present themselves as subject to male violence. But we do need to remember that those women were also very well used in many cases to engaging in violence. And the account, you know, of the transfer from Kilmainham to the North Dublin Union very much suggests that the women were kind of passive and they passively resisted. But Bridie O'Milan then talks about how she got a weapon through, you know, she the weapon didn't get picked up in the search. So I think it is important to remember that a lot of their accounts are very much kind of through the lens of what can we get in terms of propaganda.
I think it's interesting to know, too, in terms of women's violence, that when they women talk about the violence of the Cumannasirsha women, they actually say that the lady wardresses don't commit that same violence against them, that it is the Cumannasirsha women.
Darth McCardle talks about Cumannasirsha women almost kind of stripping them.
Mary, I want to go to you on the final point on this discussion, which is an area that's opened up over the last number of years. And that's the question of, you know, violence against women, including sexual violence. What is the evidence? I mean, what do we know about this?
Well, we know way more than we did know, again, as Margaret said, because of the archives we now have more access to, the military pension applications, the memoirs, the Bureau of Military History, newspaper reports. And during the War of Independence, we know that there was gendered forcible hair cropping. That doesn't happen really very much during the Civil War, although if you count the summer of 1922 in the North, it is happening then. If you see that as part of, you know, an ongoing violence, there's a huge spike in violence, gendered violence against women. There's a number of really horrific gang rapes during the Civil War that happen around the country. Most of them committed a couple by the National Army and some by the anti-treaty IRA. There is violence. There is physical violence against women. There is the infamous Kinmare case in Kerry, in which two young women are basically brought out of their house at night, taken into the backyard and from what we can gather, sexually assaulted by Paddy O'Daly and the Dublin Brigade in Kerry for all sorts of reasons to do with, you know, rivalry between different sections of the Dublin Brigade in Kerry, but also that these young women weren't paying enough attention that the local officers felt and that they had paid attention to the black and tan. So victim blaming really begins in the Kenmare case at this stage as well. And more and more, I've been going through the intelligence files on the Civil War in the in military archives, and you find a real continuous and awful attitude of the National Army to anti-treaty women. One case in Offaly where a woman made a complaint about being sexually assaulted by a private in the National Army, and he basically dismissed it, saying he didn't do it, and anyway, wasn't she just a Republican bitch, basically, and who would believe anything she said? And so there is this real antagonism towards what they call diehards, towards these women who were anti-treaty on the part of the National Army. I think a lot of it has to do with ideology, with seeing these women as, you know, awful, crazy, bloodthirsty furies. All these words were used about them, but also because of lack of training in the National Army and the fact that an awful lot of these young men aren't properly trained and aren't, you know, don't know how to behave properly within a civilian population. And it's kind of like the Crown Forces at the time. It is the civilian population who they are most fearful of, and the civilian population they can get hold of mostly are women. So you do see a lot of violence by the National Army on women. But also there is anti-treaty violence by Republican men, and there's some, as I said, horrific gang rapes that happen in this period too.
I mean, I know there's one case of a memorial up in Grace Park Road somewhere. I can't remember the name of the guy, but the guy is memorialised. But the same guy.
Oh yes, he is. Yes, he was in. It was the rape.
He's accused of rape down in Tipperary.
Yeah, yeah, you know, he is. That's the big case.
Bit of an embarrassment, you know.
Yeah.
Shifra, you've done work on testimony, Civil War testimonies. Have you anything to add on this question?
Yeah, actually, just on what Mary said, I think the whole question of gender-based violence and sexual violence has really been addressed, and it's beginning to be addressed really just in the last number of years. And I think it's really important that that's been opening up. And part of that is obviously the release of material through, as Margaret spoke about, the Bureau of Military History, and particularly the pensions that are available online. What I've been interested in, though, is the fact that if we actually go back to the material that was published earlier on, the 20s and 30s, there's no shortage of references, whether it's fictional accounts, to sexual violence against women, also against men. So obviously when you're reading these kind of writings, these aren't direct historical evidence, but what we can say is that this certainly wasn't something that was hidden or that wasn't known.
So this idea of a silence then is nonsense.
Absolutely, and I think we can talk about it in the bigger writers. We have...
Well, there is a silence, but is it a deliberate silence?
It's a silence in reception, if we think of it. It's actually that it wasn't actually addressed or spoken about. We can talk about, let's say, Liam O'Flaherty's novel, The Martyrs, Civil War narrative, and we have a rape scene in the novel against a female revolutionary. We can look at it in Paddy O'Donnell's writings. We can look at it in Seán Na Cóta, who was imprisoned in the Civil War. And we can look at it in some of the men's writings, even in terms of the humiliations of strip searching of men as well. And I think that's something that we still haven't fully addressed either. So I think that question then brings up the question of how it was normalised, perhaps in a subtle way, and also that regulates how actual sexual violence is reported and also remembered. Yeah. So it's all part of the discourse that I suppose shapes how this was something that was very much known, but that wasn't integrated into the larger narratives. And it's still a question, even in very recent books that have been written, let's say, on this period. It's still a question, I think, that still causes unease to a certain extent. And there is still a tendency maybe to downplay it still.
Can I just say one thing then to add on to what you've said, is that in going around the country pre-COVID, when we could actually go around and talk to live audiences, and when I was talking about gendered violence, generally during the War of Independence, but I would include a bit about the Civil War, loads of people would come up afterwards and say, we have this memory within the family. So I think the memories were kept not just in the literary context, but also in oral histories, and they were transmitted within families. So it wasn't forgotten, maybe by the elite and by the mainstream narratives, the history narratives, but it certainly was remembered at local level and within literary contexts, I think. Yeah.
Now, just to wrap up here, guys, and I'll throw this out to all of you, is the question of the legacy of the period we're talking about here, because the recent scholarship has shown a really vibrant scene, with suffragettes, women involved in the independence movement, in all sorts of movements, right? Yet there seems to be then this gap, over the next 40, 50 years until, second wave feminism in the 1970s, right? Nothing much seems to stir. I mean, is that a correct perception? Have I got that wrong?
I think, obviously these women who were involved in the revolutionary period went on to live their lives, and they lived real lives, and many of them were active, they were active against discriminatory legislation in the 1920s and 1930s. They were active against, for example, the lesser right of women to work, under the Conditions of Employment Act, the lack of equal jury rights under the 24 and 27 Juries Acts, the marriage bar, of course, De Valera's constitution. So you had a cohort of women, Hannah, an example, who were active against that discriminatory legislation. And then on the other side, you had women in Sinn Féin who didn't follow De Valera into Fianna Fáil in 1926, like Mary McSweeney, who maybe were kind of involved in a losing battle, but were still trying to kind of promote the idea of the second all and the Republic enshrined in name in 1916 and fought for during the revolutionary period. And of course, then in the 1940s and 1950s, 60s, you've kind of a maternalistic feminism. You've women interested in thinking about women as housewives and, their access to, foodstuff that wasn't, for example, in the context of the emergency, wasn't overpriced, around school meals for children, etc. So I think that idea that feminism was absolutely moribund between first and second wave feminism is kind of not accepted in the scholarship.
Okay, so it takes different forms.
Yes.
I mean, I think of the Irish Housewives Association, John Charles McQuaid was so concerned about it that he had one of his spies in the organisation reporting to him. And the funny thing is, she became a very effective member of the organisation, actually.
I'd absolutely agree with Leanne there. Even looking at Margaret Skinner, who I've written about, gets a job finally in 1928 as a teacher and joins the INTO. And through the INTO, for the rest of her life, really, fights for the rights of women's teachers. Mm-hmm. She joins Clann na Public, though, when it's set up, because of, her interest in the rights of workers and better social access for those outside of the middle classes, and is active with the Irish Housewives Association on pricing and different things like that. So the women get it, are still involved. They're just doing it differently. It isn't as, I suppose, sexy as the revolutionary period, but it is campaigns that they, and of course, they were all against the 37 Constitution. It keeps going on, and the next generation then takes it forward, and then the next generation takes it forward, and then it takes a different twist, I suppose, in many ways. As Leanne said, it's more maternalistic feminism. And then by the 60s, you're heading into second wave feminism. But there's always feminists there.
But also,
they're not gone.
You need to think of the legacy of the Civil War and what happened to so many of those women, which was poverty, hardship, you know, not having the space to be politically active as well, just trying to survive. You know, Maura Comerford talks about eking out a living on a poultry farm in Wexford, and it was only occasionally that she had enough money to put petrol in her tank so she could take a motorbike up to Dublin. And one of the times she says she's up there and she gets involved in the ghosts campaign and ends up in jail, but because she's she can't not be involved in things. But, you know, generally they're not politically involved because they've got so many other things. And they're not women from, other than, say, Sheila Humphreys, from wealthy backgrounds. They're single women, by and large. Yeah, they're either widows or, you know, they haven't married. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to make a living and survive.
Sheila, is it true that many of them wouldn't have applied for pensions because they want nothing to do with the Free State?
That's a good question. I think that will come in the next number of years when we actually have a full collection. We can look at that. I think that definitely there is a case that some people would have very much been opposed to the Free State and didn't want to apply for a pension. But at the same time, we have to remember how economically deprived so many of these people were. And I think one of the striking figures that we do have is if we look at the 77, some men who were executed in the Civil War, anti-treaty men, I think there's a few more than that, but 77 is the number that's stated. Nearly all of those families, as far as I know, applied for some sort of compensation from the state, even though that they were strongly associated with the anti-treaty side. And I think that's evidence of the real need, the economic need for some kind of financial compensation. Just another point to add to what Margaret was saying is emigration is another feature here. I've gone through the Cumann na mBan nominal rolls, and from the rolls anyway, we have 13% emigration of Cumann na mBan membership to mostly to the US up until the end of the 1920s. I imagine that 13% is an underestimate, but that's what the files indicate. And then the other thing is that there are some cases of women being very active when they emigrate. One case is Nellie Murray, who becomes a Republican leader in Chicago. But oftentimes it's actually the opposite, that the women don't necessarily maintain those political roles, whether that's because they are dealing with more pressing concerns, raising families, economic depression in the US, that's really what occupies, I suppose, their time.
Question from the floor there.
Just probably a self-evident question, but did the English suffragette movement provide any support to these women, or did the kind of national position override any kind of support they might have provided?
Margaret, that was one of the questions on my list I didn't get to.
I was looking at the English suffrage papers for the time of the treaty and the Civil War to see what their views were, because we don't have an Irish feminist paper anymore because the Irish Citizen stops publication in 1920. So it's interesting that during the War of Independence, the British feminist movement is really supportive of what's going on in Ireland, and they send over a lot of fact-finding delegations and are very concerned with what the Crown forces are doing in Ireland. So the Women's International League for Peace and other delegations, women from the Labour Party are very active as well. But when it comes to the treaty negotiations, I've looked at, The Vote is the paper of the Women's Freedom League. So and its founder, Charlotte Despard, now lives in Ireland and is very active. So they have a little bit more understanding, although they don't cover it that much. And the other paper is very much more unionist in its views. So they support the British government and what they're doing, and they feel that the Irish should accept the treaty, basically. What they're most interested in as feminists is really not about the wider politics. I mean, one of them does say, if civil war should come, we should, you know, better come quickly and we get it over with. But what they're interested in is the fact that in Britain there's an equal franchise movement to get women in Britain over 21 the vote. There's also a PR movement because they say there's two women in Westminster as MPs at the time. If they had PR, they reckon they could have had 80-odd women. So that they're in, and also they can't, Lady Rhonda, for example, who's a very active feminist and the editor of a feminist journal, Time and Tide, when her father dies, she can't take his seat in the House of Lords because she's a woman. Yet the Free State has women in the Senate. So from the British feminist point of view, they think Ireland is really progressive. It's got equal franchise, it's got PR, and it's got women in the upper house. And so, you know, basically, almost, it's like, what are Irish women complaining about? And then they look a bit at, you know, what women are doing post-Civil War in terms of trying to regenerate society.
This is like a sing-song here, guys. Everyone, once again, at the end. Next question.
I'm just wondering, do you think had Connolly survived or had there been a stronger leadership in the labour movement, would there have been greater representation of women both at the treaty negotiations and beyond, or would there have been less of a gap, you know, the gap you were talking about between that activism and the women's movement in the 1970s?
Mary?
I don't know, it's very hard to say, really. Because an awful lot of the women were allies of Connolly, who continued on and insisted, for example, that they have representation on the Sinn Féin executive. Margaret has written about the League of Women Delegates. So they do all of that. But of course, they're living in a patriarchal society, and gender roles at the time are very much constrained. And they are very much involved in the trade union movement, for example. I don't know if Connolly had survived, maybe. But I think we put too much on Connolly's shoulders. It's almost like if Connolly had survived, we would have achieved nirvana. And, you know, so it's almost impossible to say, because we got what we got in terms of the context of the society, of the resistance to leadership, full leadership from women and full inclusion for women. But also because of that split on the treaty, and women then seen in large part as at fault for the Civil War, as being bloodthirsty. And of course, what we forget is the big organisation that are not going to let women do anything at all. And that's the church, which has such power, particularly once the Free State is set up. And it has economic power as well as spiritual power and political connections. So I don't know if even Connolly could have taken on the might of Rome.
Hello, just wondering, somebody you haven't mentioned, and I'm wondering how much of an active role did she take in the anti-treaty movement, is Elizabeth O'Farrell. Was she involved at all?
Elizabeth O'Farrell?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, she was very much involved, I think. You see, Elizabeth is one of the ones who didn't apply for a pension or give a testimony to the Bureau of Military History.
Elizabeth O'Farrell was with Pierce when he surrendered.
Yes, yeah, who's buried out there, and I'm sure if you're going on the tour...
Sorry, Pierce was with Elizabeth O'Farrell when he surrendered.
Yes,
sorry.
Yes. and so we have very little there. She left a memoir of 1916, and as did Julia Grin and her partner, but neither of them applied for the pension and neither of them gave a statement to the Bureau of Military History. So we do know they were involved from other people talking about them in the War of Independence. They're both anti-treaty, and they never recognised the legitimacy of the Free State. And that's one of the reasons their families say that they didn't apply for the pension. So they're a couple who...
They were in Minorna Public, so,
they were, yeah.
So that was an even more kind of purist split away from Cumann na mBan later on.
Yes, they saw Cumann na mBan as not living up to the pure standards of republicanism.
Yeah. Listen, guys, we're going to have to wrap up here because there's a walking tour scheduled for 3:00, which I hope hasn't left yet, walking tour of the female revolutionaries buried here behind me. And this is
I mean, very spectacular setting here. It's a wonder you're paying attention at all with all that stuff out in front of you to look at. Listen, I'd just like to thank our panel here today, Shiafra Aiken, Leanne Lane, Mary McAuliffe, Margaret Ward. I'd like to thank Keith on sound and Amy for helping out with the radio mic. Our next Hedge School is another live one, actually. Next Hedge School is going to be on the Bleak Pettigold Triangle, and that will be in the Thurman Complex in Pettigold, County Donegal. And that's the morning of Saturday, the 28th of May. And don't worry if you can't make it, because that will be recorded as well and will be uploaded as a podcast. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you. Thank you.